All right, which brings us to item four, our review of total portfolio performance for the period ending December 31, 2024. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. A little bit different order this morning.
Yes, we've you know, we're like Major League Baseball. We're trying out different things. Now, we have adjusted the agenda in part to try to accelerate the presentation of important matters like this earlier in the agenda.
Well, we appreciate that.
That's why we're here, Scott.
Thanks for that. So, Danny and I are here today to talk about fourth quarter in 2024 performance. I'm going to start with a review of the investment landscape as I do, and so I'm going to talk a little bit about the investment landscape, and then I'll go through the chart that shows 2024 performance across asset classes as sort of a lead into Danny's comments on performance. So normally I talk a lot about economic indicators and economic factors. This time, I'm really going to focus on the political landscape because it's changed significantly. Right after I talk about some economic strength and uncertainty. So if you think about last year, the GDP came in about 2.5%. It was strong. It was a little slower than the year before, but still strong by any measure of U.S. Economic activity. Unemployment remains low. Inflation has certainly come off its post-pandemic highs. I think I'll put the landing page just on this slide, just as kind of a placeholder. But I'm going to make comments that really aren't related to the slides that are up in front of you. So inflation has come down, but still higher than the target inflation rate that the Fed would like to see. And the yield curve, importantly, has reverted, right? I've talked in past quarters about longer-term rates being lower than higher-term than shorter-term rates, and it's been like that for many years, but it's recently reverted, which indicates sort of a more normal economic environment with continued growth out into the future and higher rates reflecting that relative to longer rates reflecting that relative to shorter-term rates. So we were moving along that path through 2024. Everything is going fine, and everything continues to look like it's going fine with no real economic headwinds in the forecast. But coming out of the fourth quarter and particularly on January 20th, things changed quite a bit. So we don't or haven't historically spent a ton of time looking at politics and the political landscape and what the federal government is doing. But that's changed given that there seems to be big impacts now coming out of the activities of the new administration. This means that whereas politics and government policy were not big sources of potential economic change, they seem to be going forward. There's a lot of things out there now. With the new administration in office just over a month, the federal government has imposed, rescinded, and reimposed tariffs on Mexico and Canada, increased tariffs on China, invited the entire federal workforce to resign, withdrawn the U.S. from international organizations, ramped up deportations of illegal immigrants, and floated the idea of annexing Canada and Greenland. So a lot of things that are just sort of out there that we haven't really had to deal with in the past. We're paying more attention to this. I want to just kind of cover two of the big things that we're thinking about. One is tariffs and the potential inflationary impacts of tariffs. And then the other is the activity of the Department of Governmental Efficiency, or DOGE. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about each of those and the potential impacts that they could have on markets. So the Trump administration is taking an approach where our trading partners now are viewed more as rivals rather than as partners in a global trade ecosystem. And this could lead to a bigger piece of the pie for the U.S. in terms of economic activity and trade but maybe a shrinking pie. So that's a potential outcome. Our view is that the view of our research department is that the concerns over trade may be overblown, just based on past behavior of this administration and how the administration likes to come out big for negotiation purposes and then sort of pull back as they begin to get things that they're looking for from counterparties. There's been somewhat of an ebb and flow in the tariff narrative. So they came out hot with the announcement of 25% tariff on Canada and Mexico, purportedly with an eye towards increasing border security. So that was the thing that the administration is and was looking for, and pulled back on that as Mexico and Canada started to give concessions. A 10% across the board tariff on Chinese imports seems more like it's directed at reducing the competitive advantages that China has vis-a-vis the U.S. And trying to sort of onshore jobs and industries, reshore jobs and industries. Recently, Trump ordered a 25% tariff on all imports of steel and aluminum, and also efforts to get Mexico to try and impose tariffs on China, because a lot of things come through Mexico from China. So really looking to maybe reduce the competitive advantages that China has. Latest move that came out yesterday is to investigate the possibility of putting tariffs on copper, which also is a big, China is a big producer of copper, as is the U.S., and in fact, we are actually a net exporter of copper. So, the thought there is that, again, sort of targeting China and their competitiveness. Naturally, tariffs are inflationary, and it raises the cost of goods to importers who will reasonably and likely pass those increases on to consumers. But the ultimate impact is still unclear as we move from, threats and posturing to implementation. The unintended consequences are really unknown and potentially huge if the implementation follows the narrative. Some of the things that have happened already is the consumer confidence index fell significantly, from 105.3 in January to 98.3 that just came out in February. And that 98.3 was well below economist expectations of 103. So it's having sort of these knock-on effects as people are concerned about what these tariffs and inflationary pressures may do. That drop to 98.3 was the biggest monthly drop since August of 2021, and has just recently sort of reignited recessionary fears. So that's on tariffs, right? It's worth mentioning some of the potential benefits of tariffs would be reshoring those jobs and those industries that could increase economic activity domestically relative to where we are today.
Question.
Please.
In a real high-level macro way,
yeah.
What is your early assessment of the changes, the economic changes by reason of the political change? What's your sense or assessment of how it impacts our portfolio given how it's constructed?
Yeah. So it's really hard to say because the impacts are still playing out. Right, but if it is implemented as the narrative is moving forward, right, with those tariffs, inflationary pressures will come into play. We will likely see a recessionary environment, and so that for your portfolio being a downside protecting portfolio would be not as bad as it could be. So it'll hurt all portfolios. It will likely hurt your portfolio less, just because of your downside protection.
Do you see, maybe this is a dumb question, but I mean, do you see a potential for extreme volatility in the equities markets? So you're going to have that that kind of an effect?
Well, I think volatility is going to be the order of the day. So we're seeing a big change in policy, and this is why we're focused on politics and policy more than we have in the past. This big change, this new regime, this new landscape is leading to volatility as people are trying to figure out, what does this mean for me? How do I position or reposition, across industries, across markets, to take advantage of this new regime? And it's still playing out. So until the new regime is sort of the new normal, volatility will likely persist.
Okay, and I realize we only got as far as tariffs, so I didn't want to interrupt you. I just wanted to get an early read there. So go ahead, because similar questions.
So the response is sort of the response to all the comments that I'm having here, and that is that we can expect increased volatility until the new normal is in place, right? And your portfolio being a downside protecting portfolio, I won't say we'll benefit from that, but we'll likely suffer less from that.
Yeah, and just so you know, I'm probably going to ask the same question about when we get off of tariffs and on to the other aspects of the current admin policies, notably reductions in force.
Yeah.
As to whether and to what extent a significant reduction in the federal workforce or the federal involvement in the economy through financial means, what kind of effect that would have on a portfolio as ours is constructed. That's something that's...
Yeah, well, and so let me just jump to that, right, with a few prelude comments. So, our view is that the direct impact on the reduction in force is not that great from an overall economic perspective, right? There's 2.4 million people in government, in the federal government employment. That's less, about 1.9%, less than 2% of the total national workforce. If you think about the people that are potentially impacted, the folks with civil service guarantees make up about 80% of that 2.4 million. So we're really talking about just about 20% of that 2.4 million, a little over 200,000, which is a small slice of the overall national workforce, right? So from a direct perspective, not going to have that big an impact. Thinking more about this, there will be and could potentially be significant knock-on impacts. And one example that I can think of, just sort of off the top of my head, is national parks, right? The national parks are potentially being impacted significantly. That could have a knock-on effect with tourism and local economies. And that's, just one example of how it could, the second and third order effects that we just don't quite understand yet could be more significant. You temper that by the fact that the way that, Elon Musk runs his business and sort of Trump has behaved in the past is they try stuff and they see what's happening and then they make adjustments, right? That's how Elon Musk built rockets so quickly, right? He just put them up, it blew up. He's like, oh, that didn't work. Let's try this. Put it up again, blew up. Okay, let's try this. And so it's just sort of rapid evolutionary implementation. And I suspect that if it's not going well, they will likely pivot. It's harder to pivot, when you're breaking the federal government than it is when you're breaking a rocket. But, that's sort of the approach.
Hey, he can dock a thruster. I mean, think about it. A 6-year time frame?
Yeah.
You can do that. So, I get it's chaotic and it's not necessarily the way others might go about it, but it may have the intended result.
Yeah, right. So there's, sort of short term chaos potentially for long term gain. To your earlier question, until we reach the new normal, there will likely be, sort of extreme volatility. Extreme is not the right word. There will likely be heightened volatility.
Okay.
But based on what you just said, the new normal is trying things and then we're changing things.
How do we arrive at a new normal if the plan is to quickly change when it doesn't work?
So I think the new normal, as I'm describing it, is beyond those changes, trying something, fixing it, and changing it, and working through that process until
the new administration gets to a place where they're comfortable that they've made the adjustments to the federal government that they want to make, which are significant and far-reaching. So that's the response. And kind of the point of all this is heightened volatility. And to your portfolio, should be less impactful than to most others.
All right. Thank you. I didn't mean to get you off here.
No, it was script. You moved me along successfully, as you like to do.
I didn't do that with that intention.
No, it was great. So I'm going to take you now to the last page. Well, maybe one stop before we get to the last page. So an interesting point on this slide, as you can see, so this, just a quick explanation, this periodic table of returns takes pretty much every asset class and goes back and shows how it's moved around, and you can see asset classes move around quite a bit from, you know, the top of the chart to the bottom and throughout the middle across time. There's one new row that we've added, and that is a global 60-40 portfolio. So this is global stock, highly diversified portfolio of global stocks and global bonds. And you can see it's the red across the chart. You can see, you know, it's, as a diversified portfolio would be expected to do, it's sort of plugged along in the middle of the chart with reduced volatility. And then you can see on the right there what it's done over the last 5 and 10 years. And while the U.S. equity market has gone gangbusters, you can see the large cap growth at the top of the chart there for you know, the last few years and over the 5 and 10 year period, a globally diversified portfolio has not done as well. Still the middle of the middle of the chart, so diversification, that's the diversification effect, but you can see there for the last 5 years and 10 years sort of underperforming relative to most actuarial assumed rates. And then,
for you. Yeah, before you leave that page, I was struck looking at this page with the idea that a case could be made with all the hard work that everybody does in the investment committee and our outside advisors and our inside advisors. Someone's going to say sometime over the course of 10 years, you would have been in darn good shape if you just left your stuff in large cap growth, large cap equity, large cap value.
100%.
And just autopilot in those areas, and you worked so hard on these other areas, yeah, and you couldn't even keep up with that kind of an effort.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to respond to that, but the response that comes to the top of my mind is autopilot is really easy when you're looking backwards. So who knows if that will persist going forwards, and in fact, a lot of folks, including our research department, says based on current valuations, you're not going to get nearly those types of returns in those asset classes over the next 10 years.
They may well have said that 10 years ago, too.
Oh, in fact, they did say that.
And it turned out not to be correct.
Yeah, that's very true and a good point.
Okay, Scott, it would be interesting to see if, like, private equity or alternative investments were added to this also, so there could be a comparison because... Mm-hmm. I mean, the equity world is kind of shrinking, right? Yeah. Compared to infrastructure,
yeah,
private,
yeah, that's it's
equity
a good,
and so forth.
It's
so,
a good point. The returns are measured differently, so right, it wouldn't be perfectly apples to apples. But I'll bet we could. I'll bet we could add it to make it look like a reasonable comparison. So I'll take that back.
Is it fair that in your periodic table of returns the left column are all indices, or they are indexes or asset classes that either mark to market or have a publicly traded component,
yes,
that allows you to get the data point?
Yes.
Okay.
And they are all indexes. Yeah.
Except for cash, I guess.
Right. Well, yeah. Even cash is a,
well, you know, you're right.
30-day treasury. Yep. Okay, and then moving to the this eye chart. So I've shown this in the past. I like to just kind of point out some trends here. One of them is the table on the upper left-hand portion of the page, domestic equity. You can see the S&P 500 going back 10 years. This leads to one of the points Jerry made on the previous page. That 10-year number at 13.1% is just really high relative to long-term history of somewhere between 9 and 10%. So over 10 years, a 300 to 400 basis point premium relative to history. And then you look at large cap versus small cap. If you slide your finger down that 10-year column, you're looking at the Russell 1000 versus the Russell 2000. And you can see there, again, large cap outperforming significantly over small cap by a wide margin. And then you slide your finger down further to the next table of that 10-year column. You can look at the U.S., that S&P 500 13.1 versus the ACWI ex-U.S., which is everything outside of the U.S., and you can see the huge margin of difference there over the last 10 years. So some big, uncommon variances between what you would expect over time to have relatively similar returns, and even in some cases, like small cap over large cap and international over domestic, you would expect those to be higher than the S&P, and they just have not been over the last 10 years. And with that, I will pause, see if there are any other questions before I turn it over to Danny.
Do you have a sense of whether the outlook in Europe is likely to change in terms of let me try to rephrase that. Do you see us having a different view of Europe as a potential growth opportunity or a better opportunity than it is now based on current circumstance?
Yeah, so it's a good question, and it's an interesting one because people are starting to talk about that more and more now. Interestingly, since the beginning of the year, Europe specifically has outperformed the U.S. Pretty handily. possibly based on the overvaluation of what's been driving U.S. stock returns, which is the large cap growth, the Magnificent Seven, and they've been hit pretty hard recently for unrelated reasons to Europe. But Europe also is showing sort of green shoots of improved growth, particularly with the potential resolution of the Ukraine war, and so people are looking more favorably at Europe now than they have been for quite some time.
Great, thank you.
Sam.
How does the reciprocal tariffs play into the emerging markets or over Europe?
So with respect to Europe, Trump recently came out and said that he wanted to put across-the-board tariffs on automobiles, which will hurt Germany and in particular, which is a big part of the economic growth story in Europe. So that would have an impact. With emerging markets, so China being the biggest driver in emerging markets is, probably the biggest target of tariffs, and Mexico as well. So, should have impacts there, negative impacts there on each of those. So a big part of the emerging markets could get hit if the tariffs go into effect as sort of threatened.
And would they stand to benefit if reshoring doesn't necessarily materialize, but some of these manufacturers then go to, let's say, India, the Philippines, Vietnam, and away from China? I guess the question is, I assume that's beneficial for some of these other emerging markets?
So it would be, right, if economic activity transitions from China to Vietnam, India, some of the other emerging markets that are known for production. But I'm not sure that that's what will be the outcome, right? I think part of the Trump policy is to reshore activity. And so it's really hard to see what other emerging nations would benefit from that.
But there was an issue with supply chain, right? So trying to get away from China and into Vietnam, Indonesia, and so forth.
Yeah. Even before the concerns on tariffs,
yeah,
that supply chain diversification was happening.
Yeah, so I mean, trying to ramp up our ability to meet all of our needs in the supply chain.
Yeah,
and yet at the same time, with what happened with China and COVID and all that, so, wanting to diversify the supply.
Different dynamic than tariffs,
yeah.
But yeah, that's been going on for some time. Thank you for the questions. So, Danny, take it away.
All right, can I get the... All right, so I'll be reviewing the fourth quarter performance report. And there's really a couple of themes that I think come through throughout this report. One is 2024 was a really strong year, performance-wise, for the portfolio. So, you know, the portfolio outperformed the actuarial assumed return, also outperformed the policy benchmark. So strong absolute and relative performance. The other thing is the portfolio is transitioning, and there's been significant progress to transitioning to the new strategic asset allocation. So we'll see where the positioning is as of fourth quarter. And then the other thing I want to do, just based on the conversation that just had, is talk a little bit about kind of how the portfolio is positioned to be more resilient than many of the peers. And I'll go through a slide and kind of explain why I think that is. So starting off on the reconciliation here, looking at year-to-date, beginning market value started the year at $11 billion, net cash outflow of $154 million, so that's benefit payments largely, and then the net investment change or appreciation of $900 million gives an ending market value of $11.7 billion. So very strong year for the portfolio. If we move on to... There we go. So looking at the portfolio on the one-year column there, total fund was up 8.3% versus the policy index of 7.8, so 50 basis points of outperformance over the year. And we have the policy index and the implementation benchmark here. Just as a reminder, you know, those two things were different throughout time. They've been aligned and they're the same now. The implementation benchmark was the board resolution policy, and the policy index was the strategic asset allocation. So those two things were different. Last year that was changed, so now they're the same. But if you look out 3, 5, 10 years, those numbers are different among those two. Over the one-year period, growth, the growth bucket returned 9.7 versus the benchmark of 9.2, so really strong performance. It did have a flat or slightly negative fourth quarter. Diversifying has really been a challenging area. It's not quite meeting expectations here, down 0.4% over the one-year period and underperforming the benchmark. And there's a few things or a couple things that are happening here. One is, you know, there was a manager that underperformed that has been eliminated in the portfolio, and that return, those returns of underperformance are still being reflected in this composite. The other thing is, you know, the asterisks we have here on this slide is looking at the correlation between the growth bucket and the diversifying bucket. And that's one of the things we pay attention to on a regular basis. If you go back to last year when we presented this report, the one-year number for the correlation between growth and diversifying was 0.81. So it has come down. It's to 0.65, but that's still higher than we expect this to be, right? And so what's causing that? Really, if you think about that equity bond correlation, that's really the big driver here. So if you go back to the tech crash of the late 90s, early 2000s, you go back to the great financial crisis, having bonds and equities together in your portfolio benefited investors tremendously because there was a negative correlation between those assets. So as equities fell, bonds protected your portfolio. That relationship changed post-COVID. And so, you know, that's what's really happening behind the scenes here on this relationship. So expectations are that that's going to go back to the long-term trend of providing diversification, but that's been a little bit painful in this bucket over the shorter, medium term.
Do you, trying to figure out how to ask this, so we went to FFP in 2016. I think that was my close, Tim? Yeah. So in that time frame, and of course it wasn't like flipping a switch, right? It's transitioned over a number of years. But during that same period of time, I think I've read anyway that some other funds and systems have gone to similarly designed portfolios in the sense of having functionality in various buckets. And my question is, are there other funds who are trying to employ a risk diversifying strategy that have had a different experience? In other words, are the headwinds in this area consistent for everybody that's trying it? Is there something that works and something that notably doesn't? Or
yeah, so there are lots of other plans that are doing similar approaches to you. And I think what I just described of this relationship between two of the largest asset classes that most investors have in their portfolio kind of breaking down, everybody felt that. So certainly weren't alone there. The positioning, though, within diversifying has maybe been slightly different. I don't know if you're going to add a comment to that.
Well, no, I was going to add that it requires additional investigation to go and look at specifically who has put in FFP-type portfolios, when they've done it, and what their performance has been and what's driven that performance. But it's worth investigating.
Yeah, and maybe I shouldn't have boxed it in with an FFP example. Whoever's running a risk diversifying strategy, right? I guess I'm just curious, and maybe in your own experience for the funds, your other funds that you all represent, what's been their experience with that? And because it seems to, I mean, I know it's been a persistent challenge. We've made a lot of changes and been through different managers and strategies. So.
Yeah, so at a high level, so I've got one other client that is following an FFP-like diversifying strategy. They came on board about 5 years ago and have had a similar experience to yours, largely because what it does is it increases the portfolio efficiency, but it sort of reduces the risk relative to peers. And in a risk-on environment, it has underperformed relative to peers because of that. So that one example, the performance has been similar. But I'm interested, and I'll look into it.
Okay, thank you.
Across the board.
Is the custom diversifying benchmark, is that investable? I mean, is that something we just simply try to mimic that? Because I mean, that's a 4-point spread. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I believe we're using all indices for that. I'm not entirely. I'd have to take a look if they're all investable indices, but it should be.
It's largely investable.
Sorry?
It's largely investable.
There might be some absolute return benchmarks, though, which are not investable in there. Like so plus 3%.
You think one of the main reasons was because of the underperformance of one particular manager?
I think
and that person is no longer with us.
I think it's partially there's a manager, Acadian, that was in this asset class that was underperforming and has been liquidated. And I think the other big component, and Scott might have another one too, the other big component is this relationship between equities and bonds that broke down. So it didn't behave the way we expected it to post-COVID.
Yeah, I just comparing it to the benchmark, however, that had a level of success. And compared to us, and so if that's in the same realm, then there's parts of that should work. I mean, correlation with bonds and equities should impact that also. But
yeah, so there's two components in the diversifying bucket. One is fixed income, right? And I think there's AFL-CIO fund in that sub bucket, and that manager's been doing well. the area that struggled is that multi-asset bucket, which is where Acadian was. And the new fund that's added has underperformed so far, but largely Acadian, I think, is the explanation there. It had some significant underperformance, and that's still being reflected in this composite. One bright area is the liquidity bucket here.
Yeah, we like bright areas.
Yeah. So, you know, the job of this, of the liquidity bucket, is to pay benefit payments, but we're also getting some pretty strong capital appreciation here, up 5% over the last year. So not what we expect the liquidity bucket to be doing, but great to see that, and great to see it outperforming its benchmark, too. I want to touch on this just really quickly, given the discussion that was being had this morning on how do you deal with all this uncertainty, what does it mean for the portfolio? And so if we look at the bottom chart, the five-year risk versus return, and as a reminder here, you know, bottom right is where you want to avoid, top left is ideally where you'd like to be. But if we look at where the portfolio and the implementation and the implementation benchmark and the policy index are today, I think there's a few things that we can take away from this that show us that this portfolio is positioned to be resilient given the uncertainty that's in the marketplace. One is, we've talked about this already, the volatility or the standard deviation of this portfolio is low relative to many peers. So the range of outcomes around your expected returns is more narrow. So that's a good way to position yourself to be more resilient. Another way to position yourself, your portfolio, to be more resilient is to avoid or minimize tail losses. So by having a lower standard deviation, taking on less volatility risk, also having lower drawdown risk, which is what this portfolio is positioned as, is another way to be resilient. And then the third is making sure that you're earning as much return as you can per unit of risk. And so if we look at our dots here on this chart, you can see that all the dots horizontally to the right are plans that are earning a similar return but taking on a lot more risk than this plan. We can always move vertically up, right, and earn more return for the risk that we're taking, and that would be nice. But this is showing me that we're kind of hitting on those three points of low volatility, low drawdown risk, earning a strong return per unit of risk. And so that's really just a few ways that you can construct and be more resilient as a plan. And I think that that's what this shows us here. Just another perspective, though, on the how do you position yourself for all this uncertainty.
I was kind of thinking like, sometimes I wonder if we think like an insurance company, right? In terms of you restructuring a portfolio to manage a full service insurance type of business, many if not all of the same factors come into play, right?
Yeah.
It seems to me. I just don't know where their dots would align on this particular chart. I'm curious, who's the top dot? Do you know who that is?
I don't know if we can. I think the database is anonymous, all the peer groups.
Always curious about an outlier. Well, it's an outlier.
All right, and then so I'll dive back into performance here, net of fees. There we go. So, looking at the growth bucket over the 1 year period, I think, you know, like I said, 2024 was a strong year. All managers within the growth bucket had positive performance, all asset classes, with the exception of private real estate. And we've talked about that quite a bit over the last year, as we're still dealing with write-downs in that space. All the domestic equity managers outperformed their respective benchmarks over the 1 year period. International equity, Scott kind of went over this and showed the difference between domestic and international. And international equity had a rough fourth quarter, and these managers in the space did underperform their benchmarks. Looking at emerging market equity, we had a strong one-year performance of 13.1%. PIMCO was pretty close, outperformed its respective benchmark, but the real shining star there is TT Emerging Markets. If you look at what they did over that one-year period, up 19.1% versus its the MSCI Emerging Market benchmark at 7.5. So that's really hitting it out of the park, and that's we generally think they've said that they expect to have tracking error in the range of 4 to 7%. So outperformance over a one-year period of 1,000 basis points is definitely an outlier. Don't expect that every year, but it's nice to see it. This is really – oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry. How much does that 19% make up for the years where they've been kind of lagging?
I mean, you can look out further, kind of the impact that it's had. So at 5 years, it's up 1.9 versus its benchmark of 1.7. So it makes up quite a bit, but they're not terribly far off from their benchmark when you look at the five-year period.
And you can see their since inception return going all the way back to August of 2017 at 3.4. I'm looking at gross of fees, but 3.4 versus their benchmark at 2.5.
And so they're positioning their overweight right now in Argentina as well as India and Taiwan, and so those bets really paid off for them. And then we've talked a little bit about this before, but they structurally don't believe in China. So they're underweight China. They think that they're going to have a really hard time transitioning away from this export-based economy to more consumption-driven, consumer-driven consumption economy. So it worked out really well for them in 2024. Looking at private credit here, private credit has been an incredibly strong performer in the portfolio. If we look out, you know, one-year performance at 11.9, if you go out 5 and 10 years, annualized returns of 9%. This has just been a great addition to the portfolio. It's been a really strong performer. Within high yield, Voya, we talked about this last quarter. Their underperformance there over the one-year period was largely due to this positioning that they had or didn't have within the triple C credit quality. So those lower quality bonds really rallied in the third quarter, and that's the explanation for them underperforming over the one-year period. Looking at real estate, while over the one-year period, we did see positive returns in the REIT space. We continue to see write-downs within private real estate. So we may be close to turning that corner, but it hasn't happened yet. Private equity returns have been relatively flat over the 1 and 3 year period, but one of the best performing, if not the best performing assets over the 5 and 10 year period. Private infrastructure has been added in the portfolio, and risk parity has almost been liquidated as of 4Q, just some small holdback there within the Panacora Fund. We already talked about the diversifying bucket, so I won't hit on any more of that. But in summary, I think a really strong 2024. This portfolio is positioned to be resilient for the uncertainty that we talked about, and I think there's been some significant progress on this transition to the new strategic asset allocation. With that, I'm going to stop and see if there's any additional questions.
Remind me what the Voya issue was. I know we talked about it previously, but I need a little more context on that.
Yeah, so the benchmark holds a higher allocation to these triple C rated bonds, which is just like it's one step above default. So they're the lowest rated bonds you can hold. And Voya is basically not holding those in the portfolio. So they're holding higher quality bonds. So they missed out on that rally. These triple C rated bonds did really well in the third quarter, and Voya missed out on that. That's why they underperformed their benchmark.
And did other managers not miss out on that? In the same space?
It's kind of hard to say. I mean, it depends on the structure of the manager and if they're more safety-based or if they're taking on higher risk. This one's positioned to be a little safer in the portfolio, so they missed out.
Well, I was kind of thinking back to Jerry's comment earlier about index funds in general, right? We could, you know, we're chasing alpha, man, every minute of every day, and we're going at it, and we're You know, and we incur costs, but we're paying for top flight managers and understand that. And so I guess what I'm really trying to get at is the whiff on the bonds from Voya one that just about every other hitter would hit and should have and did hit? That's really what I'm trying to figure out.
So you can look at the gross of fee page. Let's see if I can get you there. And you can see their rank relative to other managers of their style in those rankings, and you can see that they have they've missed relative to other managers, which would imply that other managers are dipping down into that lower quality and getting those higher returns when times are good, taking that additional risk and getting paid for it relative to Voya.
So what, in terms of our thought about Voya, I'm not trying to pick on them today. I'm just wondering, so from the standpoint of manager management and how we view our managers, are we concerned that that was a horsepower lapse? That's maybe an unfair question, but
it's a question that I'm not prepared to answer right now, but something worth looking into for sure.
So we, okay,
we review, you know, managers across time, and when specific incidents arise, we haven't looked at Voya specifically in detail, and it may be about time to.
So maybe just add a little context there. Voya is structurally higher credit quality. That's part of their philosophy. They are structurally and permanently under-deployed to CCC. So you're buying into a higher credit quality portfolio there. We identified this issue a couple of years ago, and we've been using this as a funding source, both for private credit. So we've been drawing down against this funding private credit. And if you recall, last August, the board approved multi-asset credit, which is high yield and bank loans and other things like that. When those are funded, which should happen in the next couple of months, Voya will get drawn down. So this is we recognize their structural bias. It is a parking place in the short term, for lack of a better word, and we fully anticipate once multi-asset credit is funded in the second quarter or so, that will be drawn down.
Okay. No, that's helpful. I mean, we knew what we were buying, and we did it with intention, right? But it turned out that there's a different aspect of this market that we may want to rebalance.
Yeah, and we 100% looked at this and said, well, is that the exposure we want? And the answer was no, multi-asset credit is the exposure we want. And the secondary question is, do we need to get out in the short term, or is it okay, and is it good enough in the short term? And we said, this is going to be I think we said 6 to 9 month transition period, and we're running ahead of schedule on that. So that'll be, it's a short term plug for that exposure that's going to migrate to multi-asset credit.
Got it. Thank you. It's helpful.
Thank you.
All right.
That concludes all right, our remarks.
So other questions? I didn't mean to dominate this, but David.
Yeah. So one thing that we were hoping for in 2025 would be decreasing interest rates that would make it a more favorable environment for private equities to have some exits that they haven't been doing because of unfavorable terms. Given that we're facing with the tariffs and the DOGE and all that stuff going on with politics, there's a chance that inflation may pick up. So rates may actually not go down like they were anticipating, probably hold steady, and there's a risk that they may go up. How is that going to impact our returns on private equity this year? Because there was that big hope that rates are lower, we can have more favorable terms in getting out of these investments.
So we've been on sort of a telling a story of higher rates for longer for quite some time, with the notion that interest rates are going to be range bound, sort of in the 10-year Treasury in the 4.5 to 5 range into the foreseeable future. So from our perspective, we weren't anticipating that big wave of exits due to decreasing rates. Interestingly, rates have started to come down relative to our expectations and relative to recent history. I think right now the 10-year Treasury is at 4.3%. And that's just a recent result of concerns about, re-emerging concerns about recession based on the impact of the things that we talked about earlier. So it may in fact come about that rates do come down a little bit relative to expectations and that higher for longer narrative. I think so. There's two components to your return, right? One is realized exits. One is just mark-to-market changes. And I think just based on our expectations with private equity, you can continue to expect them to outperform public market equities going forward. You just won't have the cash flows that you might expect to reinvest in other opportunities. But the returns, although they've been muted in the past, we're not expecting any reason for them to be muted going forward.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
Sure. I guess I would echo one of Scott's comments from earlier of markets adjusting to new normals. And we certainly saw private equity go on an absolute tear in 2021 when rates were coming down. It was really cheap to borrow. A lot of companies were for sale, and you just saw tremendous activity. I think our program was up 60% in value that year. Huge return. When rates started back up on the inflationary cycle, that really put a damper on it. So you had two things happening. One, you pulled a lot of activity forward into 2021 that might have naturally happened over the next couple of years. And then you had a less favorable interest rate environment. The hope for lower rates to trigger activity is a hope. It'd be nice, but I don't think that's the baseline. I think the baseline is this is probably a more normalized interest rate environment going forward in this range, and funds are going to have to be able to find ways to transact. And so, you've seen a little bit of pickup in activity in the second half of the year on the margins, not a huge trend, but on the margins you've seen a pickup in activity. In our conversation with private equity managers, they're looking at 25, 26, and 27 as more normalized transaction volume years, but I think this is everybody has to get used to this interest rate environment. If your execution model doesn't work in this interest rate environment, well, you're not going to have a fund going forward. And then once the partners, the buyers and sellers kind of say, like, okay, this is a 5% borrowing world. What does that do to my price? Okay, this is a realistic price, and we're going to go ahead and transact. That's what we're starting to see green shoots of. I'd be hard-pressed to say the trend has begun, but we've seen green shoots there. But I think this is if a manager is saying, we're not selling our companies until we see 3% interest rates, I don't see a viable path forward for that type of general partner. I think this is a process to get the valuations reset between buyers and sellers and then move forward. And that's probably, like I said, over a course of 3 years or so. If you did see rates come down by 100 or 200 basis points, yes, you would see a pickup activity. But I think the broader trend is just they're having to adapt to this new interest rate environment.
Managing expectations of buyer and seller kind of thing?
It's an interesting world. When you look at what the prices were paid for in 2021 and a little bit into 2022, a lot of great companies were for sale, but they were for sale at premium prices. Okay, you bought a great company, and now you have to operationally improve it, but your valuation has come down. So you've seen a lot of general partners say, like, we know we have a great company. The operational improvements are going to take 4 or 5 years to come through in the bottom line. Maybe we just hold them longer, have the companies more well-established, and then take them back to market. The downside of that is those companies keep getting larger and larger as private companies. And you really need the public market to be available in an exit environment. And haven't quite got there on a lot of industries yet, but it's kind of an industry by industry trend, but I think this is a 3-year trend, not a 1-year open the floodgates kind of thing.
Thank you.
Another kind of interesting corollary. It reminded me of the old saying that everybody knows, which the market hates uncertainty. And so last year was supposed to be an M&A year. It's not. Then they said, well, the first quarter of this year will be an M&A quarter. It's not. So I think people are sitting on the sidelines waiting to find out when it's time to start making some moves, and it's not time.
Yeah. And you've seen a lot of creativity within the private equity community where they're saying, you know, I'm not getting the price I want for this company. Can I put it into a continuation vehicle, a single asset continuation vehicle? And your limited partners can roll their interest into this. They basically say, you know, if you believe in this company, but you don't like the valuation today, but you like the cash flow from it, you can put it in a separate vehicle and continue to hold it. That works for trophy companies. It doesn't work for troubled companies. But these are solutions to expectations that are a little bit out of alignment with reality. So it is going to be at a certain point in time, your companies are worth what the market will pay you. If you don't like what the market pays you, but you like the cash flow, then you hold it forever. So that's kind of the process we're going through right now.
Real world investing.
Yep.
Yeah. All right, so are we...
No other questions?
No other questions.
That
thank you.
Concludes our report.
Thank you, Scott and Danny. All right. Mr. Price.
All right. In the interest of brevity, given that we've spent an hour on performance, we're going to go through this relatively quickly. I think what I want to touch on as I go through the CIO report is less on performance and more about progress towards implementation of the asset allocation, is give you some kind of real-time updates on where we are in that. And can we bring up the memo? Oh, I'm going to have to click 100 times, but can we jump forward? That's a lot of clicks, but we'll get there. So if you recall back to August of last year, we talked about doing a three-phase implementation of the new asset allocation. So phase one was basically the liquid markets that we can move now were moved now, and that was really winding down risk parity and doing some rebalancing within the equity markets. Thank you. Phase two was building out the new allocations, and there was four new allocations, and it was building out a dedicated treasury exposure, building out hedge fund exposure, building out multi-asset credit, and building out real estate credit. And so we'll touch base on where we're at in those processes, because we are very much in a moving target environment. What you're seeing on the paper is where we were in phase one implementation, and then we're in the process of phase two implementation now. So let me go to liquidity, where we're basically looking at this, and you know, things are kind of operating as we expect. I think the nice takeaway here is you take a look at the yields. The yields in the 4 and 5% range. You take a look at the one-year returns. Your returns are in the 4 and 5% range. It's just, it's kind of working. It's giving us what we're expecting there, and we're actually getting a decent yield off this portfolio for the first time since 2016. we went in at relatively low rates. I went into COVID, those rates dropped. Obviously, the rates have come back up, and now this thing is operating in a more positive fashion here. Go to page six here on the growth portfolios. You know, I think most of the growth portfolios are in kind of relatively decent shape. You see some trends here. One correction, you see on Pureford's line there, it shows a large, large gain for the product. That was a data error. They actually had a small loss. They were down 11% in the product. But for the most part, everybody's in kind of growth mode here. On the performance front, a couple of things I would highlight here. Gentlemen from Verus have touched base on TT, that sharp recovery, up 19% in 1 year, bringing in those, you know, recovering a lot of the losses of the prior 3 years. We've talked at length about the retirement of Niall Ferguson, who was really the architect of the strategy, and turned it over to his two lieutenants. I think their implementation is slightly different. It's certainly more willing to take country bets than it was previously, and I think you're seeing that pay off, particularly in the Argentina exposure, which was, you know, it's been a pariah in the global markets until their new president came in last year and really has shaken up the economy there. So I think that recovery is really great to see. Artisan as well, even though it's operating in global growth, so it has a lot of exposure to, or its benchmark has a lot of exposure to the Magnificent Seven and those sorts of companies, and we've seen a lot of lagging there. They've caught back up a bit relative to expectations, so they're meeting expectations now. The real estate write-downs continued in 2024. We've talked about that. I think one important thing to note is we did see transaction volume pick up 45% in the second half of 2024. So commercial real estate from, you know, down 60, 70% from pre-COVID picked up a lot in the second half. It's nice to have recovery from a trough, but that doesn't really tell you if you're back to normal. So just a couple of metrics there. So the four main food groups within real estate is industrial, hotels, retail, and office. And so if you take a look at industrial, it's at 94% of pre-COVID levels, so it's almost back. This is on volume, not pricing, just the volume of transactions. Hotels at 86%, you're most of the way back. Retail, 75%, still some challenges there. Offices at 40%. So you really have a tale of two marketplaces here. You have where people are spending time and where people are not spending time. If you're not spending time there in the offices, it's really tough to get those, you know, the transaction volume back up. But industrial, hotel, retail, you know, in good shape there. On the new asset classes, so within the growth portfolio, the two new asset classes coming in, multi-asset credit, you've seen the quiet period notices. We're well underway of underwriting there. I would anticipate funding those in the second quarter. And then real estate credit, we're in the process of funding one essentially now and a second one over the next month or so. So there's been a lot of progress. And then you're talking about 7% of the total fund here. So 10% of the overall growth allocation that is shifting. That's a material shift on top of what was already done with winding down risk parity and rebalancing the equity market. So a lot of things in motion there.
Tim, question.
Yeah.
Do you actually anticipate or see anything being discussed about available government buildings? Because it's a little early, but the buildings that are see-through buildings that are unoccupied, partially because people are working at home and partially because people aren't even there. It's just amazing. There's a property in San Francisco. I see this as political payback to some degree, but Pelosi's building, he wants to now sell it. He says it's a dog of a building. It was put in a crappy neighborhood. It was never had any tenants in it, and he wants to get her name off of it, obviously. Are there more possibilities of government buildings becoming available?
Not that we have seen in terms of what our managers are highlighting as the pipeline. That said, all of our managers are focused elsewhere from office buildings. So it hasn't been with our manager roster. If it's a diversified fund and has office as part of its investable universe, that's been the lowest activity. That's been an asset management exercise, try to improve what you have now, sell what's stabilized. But I haven't seen people come in with purchases on distressed buildings, and if it's a see-through building, it would probably be a distressed price. In our manager roster, we haven't seen a whole lot of that. I've seen a couple of headlines. Larger funds have done a bit of that, but it's not prevalent in our portfolio. So I don't have a lot of great insight on specifically government office buildings transacting and what they're going for and that sort of thing.
I can't see a lot of them being described as grade A buildings, but by the same token, solid.
Yeah, I think
available space.
What we are seeing within the office sector is, if you have a building built in 2014 or more recently, that is, you know, 40 to 80% leased, those will transact.
Yeah.
If it's pre-2014 and there's some building code changes right around then. It might be cash flowing, but there's really not a demand from buyers for that. And if you're talking, you know, pre-1980, there's just, you know, you're looking at land redevelopment. So it's, you know, the value of the land minus the cost of demolition. And if it's still cash flowing with tenants in it, nobody's going to sell at that price. And so you see a lot of depressed volume that, you know, only 40% back to normal in that space. Yeah. And so it really is if you have Class A, in a market that's recovering, so Los Angeles, Dallas, those markets are recovering. You're seeing, you know, volume pick up there. Great. If you got a Class B in, a secondary or tertiary city, unless you're fully occupied on a long-term lease, they're there. There's cash flow associated with them, but they're not transactable on the commercial real estate market right now. And I should say that you'll have recalled that in the past year and a half, 2 years, the vast majority of what we've done within private real estate has been in alternative sectors, so away from these four food groups into data centers and hospitality and a couple of other things that are more specialized. But that's been where the more demand has been, and in the industrial sector as well. So let me turn to diversifying real quick and just highlight here that we've had a conversation with the investment committee about treasury exposure. Trustees would have seen a quiet period notice go out earlier this week about manager we're taking a look at there. So we anticipate if that is a successful due diligence, you'll have another addition here. The hedge fund, I think that's a little bit, we've taken a little bit of a step back from that right now simply because we have in the midst of the consultant search, and that's going to require the involvement of consultants. So that one's a little bit pushed back, but everything else is proceeding on target there. And then we always have this chart, and I always struggle to convey what it actually says. And so this is the upside downside market capture. And what we realized is we've had a lot of quarters that were very, very positive and very few quarters that were somewhat negative. And so the percentage of market capture wasn't telling the whole story. So we added this and basically says, if that benchmark is up, that's the red line in the individual quarter. If the benchmark was up, you'll see that we captured some but not all of it in most cases. I think more importantly, when the benchmark is down, you see that less capture ratio. So we are downside protecting. You see a couple periods, the fourth quarter being an instance here where the market or the benchmark was down slightly. We captured kind of all of it, but it was a small number in an absolute sense. So I think this is probably a little bit more indicative of that smoother ride that we're trying to engineer of not capturing all the upside, not capturing all the downside, and providing some protection over time there. With that, I would pause and see if there's any questions from the trustees. But we've talked about performance for quite a while here. So,
Tim, real quick, I'm sorry. The red bar, that's the range?
So the red bar would be the simplified target index. So this is the completely public market index that kind of says if you just did public markets with your asset allocation, so no private markets whatsoever, what would a proxy have been? And then we measure it. So this is measuring, are we adding value with manager selection? Are we adding value with private markets? That sort of thing here. And what you see is generally we'll protect on the downside. So if the public markets are down quite a bit, there's a protection buffer there. If the public markets are up quite a bit, we're capturing that upside, but not all of that upside. And so it's just that you have a smoother line over time. Still not perfectly smooth, obviously. This is a quarter to quarter. It's not smooth at all, but you do see that, that role of diversification there that's playing, that it's adding some value.
Could you go back one slide and then that inflection point? I don't know if that's April of 2024.
Yep.
Can you talk about what probably caused that and how long you think that's going to stay?
Yeah, so we see the downside capture creeping up there. And then the upside capture coming down. So you have to kind of look at those two things separately there. I am a little bit more concerned with the upside capture. I think the downside capture is working. The downside protection is working. I think the upside capture, part of that is private markets not delivering relative to the public markets over that particular 3-year period. So the 3 years ending at the end of the year there. Particularly with private equity, you had that blockbuster 2021. 22, 23, 24, muted. Okay, well, there's a big chunk of your portfolio. You're depending on that for a lot of growth, and you've kind of had three muted years while the public markets have really gone on a tear. Real estate is going to be another one. So real estate is not reflected in the benchmark here because the benchmark is just the global equity benchmark for that. And you've been down in that space. So I think that a lot of that is a reflection of the private markets over this particular 3-year period. Again, like I said, they pulled a lot of activity forward to 2021, and you've had three muted years. The downside capture is a little bit more technical. And if you take a look at the last 3 years, there's not been a whole lot of down markets. So 2022, you had three down quarters, and we saw protection there. Then you saw little blips in 23 and 24 that were negative. Those little blips, one of those is 140% capture ratio, because the benchmark was down 0.6, and the total fund was down 0.9. Okay, well, that's a 30 basis point difference. But it shows up in the other chart as 140% capture. So that's where, you know, we looked at this and like, I'm not sure this is telling a useful story for trustee monitoring. And that's why we added this secondary chart here. But I think the tail of the downside capture ratio is you had high capture of low negatives. So if the market's down 10% and, you know, the total fund was down 11%, you'd have 110% capture ratio. If the market's down 1% and you're down 2%, you'd have 200% capture ratio. It's still the same 1% underperformance. But that's kind of the tail there. So when you have these very small negatives, it distorts that percentage, and that's why we added the actual raw data here.
No, I appreciate you adding me the nuance of why it is. With the inclusion, this is attempting to clarify that. I guess it would be helpful from my perspective, since the original is still included, is also saying, because it is a three-year rolling, how soon you think that blue line more likely is going to revert to mean.
And this, just to be clear, this is probably the last time you see this format. The new format is coming to the investment committee in the next
perfect
month or so.
Then don't worry about it.
there's a new and improved coming down the road here.
Any other questions to Tim? Not hearing any.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, now that we're done with the lighter part of the agenda, we can move on.